Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. Coming up on today's program, India executes sole surviving gunman from the Mumbai attacks. First group of asylum seekers arrive on Manus Island. HIV infection on the rise in parts of Asia. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Just 5 days short of the fourth anniversary of the Mumbai terror attacks, India has executed the sole surviving gunman involved. Pakistani-born Mohammad Ajir Kasab was hanged earlier Wednesday morning after India's president rejected his plea for clemency. Kandahar Sapati reports.
Mohammad Ajmal Kasab was secretly hung in Yerwada jail close to Mumbai after President Pranab Mukherjee rejected his plea for mercy earlier this month. His execution has been welcomed by many in India who see it as a tribute to all those who lost their lives in the November 2008 Mumbai attacks. This is Mukhtar Abbas Naqvi, the leader of India's main opposition, Bharatiya Janata Party.
Kasab's hanging is a case of better late than never. It's a stern message to the enemies of the nation, especially those sitting outside our boundaries and spreading fear in the country and the world at large.
The terror unleashed by the heavily armed Islamist gunmen on Mumbai's luxury hotels, a Jewish center, a hospital and a train left 166 people and 9 gunmen dead. Ajmal Kasab, who was caught on television footage opening fire and throwing grenades at Mumbai's main train station, once caught, became the iconic image of the three-day siege. India's last execution was conducted in 2004. And many on death sentence continue to languish in prison. Unlike Ajmal Kasab, who was executed just 2 years after being handed the death penalty in May 2010. So is India sending a message out to the militants and Pakistan? Dr. Ajay Sani, Executive Director of the Institute of Conflict Management and the South Asia Terrorism Portal in New Delhi, does not think so.
This was a particular case in which there was tremendous public pressure for action. And the action has consequently been taken much faster than is the normal case with the judicial and appeals process for a death penalty. So it is a positive symbolic incident at best, but I don't think it would have any long-term bearing on India's overall orientation towards terrorism or towards Pakistan or any of the issues involved.
India blames the Pakistan-based Lashkar-e-Taiba militant organization for training, equipping and financing the gunmen with support from elements within the military. Pakistan has admitted that the attacks were planned partly from its soil but denies any official involvement. Although Pakistan has arrested and charged 7 members of the Lashkar-e-Taiba under its anti-terrorism law for the Mumbai attacks, the proceedings against them have not moved since the preliminary hearings in 2009. So will Ajmal Kasab's execution nudge Pakistan into action? Talat Masood is a retired Army Lieutenant General and political analyst.
Well, I think the pressure will continue because this is one of the very sore points between India and Pakistan at the moment, because India expects that Pakistan should expedite the cases. To that extent, I think the pressure will continue to mount. And obviously, this execution also is a reminder and will for a while at least to put greater pressure on Pakistan. But I think Pakistan itself in its own interest will have to act.
Dr. Sani says Indian pressure has not worked so far and more is needed to push Pakistan into prosecuting the perpetrators of terror.
Whether or not any change occurs within the Pakistani context will depend more on the degree to which international pressure acts on Pakistan and if there is any change in the perception of power elite in Pakistan. Only then would you have any possibility of serious action being taken against the perpetrators of the 26/11 attack.
And that report came to us from Kandahar Sapati. The first group of 19 asylum seekers from Australia arrived on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea this week. The families from Iran and Sri Lanka were flown in from the Australian Detention Centre on Christmas Island for processing. There was tight security with riot police present at the Momoate airport as they were being taken to the center. Ronnie Knight, a Manus MP, says the Islanders welcome the detainees, but are upset about what they see as Australian and Fijian governments rushing through the project. Mr. Knight says local people have missed out on security and catering contracts and want outstanding concerns resolved before the group of the 600 asylum seekers finally arrive on Manus. Fermi Nannall speaks next to Ronnie Knight.
They've been taken straight to the processing center, and they will be there for some time until they are sorted out. And mostly there were families, no individuals. This one was just families, probably Afghanistan or Iraq or somewhere like that. They said they were going to trial 25. The total processing facility is set up for 600, so within the next month or so, there should be 600 people on the ground.
Member, do you think the facility is enough to cater for 600 asylum seekers?
Yeah. There's enough tents and everything there on the ground at the moment for them to do that. There's no problem.
The people on Manus Island were a bit concerned over benefits and generally contracts they were going to get from the regional processing center. Is that issue being settled, or is there an issue still outstanding that both the Australian and PNG government and the Manus provincial governments need to iron out?
I think there was a lot of disinformation in the first place. To be honest with you, it has to be sorted out. We must sort it out. Looking at this development budget that came in today, both me and the governor are really disappointed. They told us that, you know, you won't get anything that is not in the development package, and the Australian government will give what they want to the PNG government, and the PNG government will look to help the provincial government. With the project part of the budget, Manus got nothing out of it.
The Australian government and PNG government working out something separately as far as the Manus Regional Processing Center was concerned and demands from the landowners. So that doesn't seem to be the case now, is it? Is that what you're saying?
No, no. What Australia has committed, that $8 million Australian dollars to Manus, that is very little in what we are looking at. We're really happy with what extra they can give us, but we expected PNG to be happy with us for providing Manus. And we expected our government to give us a little bit more long-term projects, but that didn't happen.
So what particular things are the people of Manus looking at, like what kind of contracts in specific? Like for the security, there's a company called G4S already engaged.
This is a contentious issue that we're talking about. We don't want G4S there. G4S took over from the former Protec Wormhold, and they left a lot of people unpaid, left a lot of Manus landowner guards stranded in Mosby. Now, we have the capacity to handle the security contracts. That was from day one we told them that. We also told them that, catering. We have to at least give something to our landowners. Obviously, at the end of the day, it is state land. It is the Australian government talking to the PNG government over state land. You can understand that. But that land was probably appropriated by the German government before from land of original landowners for, you know, maybe some beads and maybe some bags of clothing or some tobacco sticks or something at that time. So people are still, you know, looking at trying to get what they can out of it. Unfortunately, with our people at home, getting their act together in a way that they come together as single front. Mm-hmm. Too many fractions. People saying two or three different landowner companies, and I think that maybe they took advantage of that. That could have been the problem in the first place.
Would the Manus people and the U.S., the leader, would you welcome if there was an extension for them to stay longer, more than a year, or even integrate into Manus?
Well, I think it's supposed to be a long-term thing. They're looking at putting a permanent facility on the island. But I'm telling you now that the way it was done, with the riot squad on the ground, we have not done this diplomatically with the people. So we're looking at problems down the track, maybe small problems. And now they put the mobile squad in Manus. They need to keep them there because obviously as soon as they leave, something will happen. With me, as a politician and as member for Manus, if Australia wants to be genuine about this, and they could have told us, you know, we could have, you know, sorted out security ourselves, and that would be on the table for all the local business, and the landowners could come in with that and an umbrella company. With catering, I expect that at least give the catering to the landowners. They can cater. They have engineers there. They have cooks. They have their profile is up to date. And if worse comes to worse, give them the money and they will bring in new rest or pool catering, whoever else if they can handle it. So something stays at home. And at the moment now, it's just a repeat of 2001. I wasn't a politician then, but I was involved as a policeman with my unit looking after the security at Longroom.
Burma's opposition leader and Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi has accepted a new role as ambassador of the UN Program on AIDS and HIV, saying she wants to be the voice of the voiceless. UNAIDS says the key to her new role is fighting discrimination against people living with the disease. News of the appointment came as the UN agency released its annual global report on HIV/AIDS ahead of World AIDS Day on September 1st. Steve Krause is the UNAIDS Regional Director for Asia and the Pacific. He says while there's good progress that's been made in many areas, a number of countries have seen an increase in infection rates. He speaks next to Sen Lam.
First of all, countries are reporting on the HIV/AIDS epidemic like they've never had before. So we've got better quality reporting and more countries reporting. In Asia, in South Asia, in Southeast Asia, and East Asia, the picture's a bit mixed. We see a number of countries that have had major reductions of 25% or more in the last 10 years, and these are very impressive gains. This would include a whole host of countries like Cambodia, India, Malaysia, Myanmar, Nepal, Papua New Guinea, and Thailand. But at the same time, we see a number of countries, perhaps like Bangladesh, certainly Indonesia, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and Pakistan, where the rates of new infections actually have increased by 25% in the last 10 years. Overall, some very good progress in large countries, but also 3, 4, 5, 6 countries where the infection rates not only haven't gone down, but they've actually gone up.
Well, we'll go to those countries a little bit later, but for the countries that are doing well, what are some of the contributing factors to this drop in new infections?
I think that, Sen, the answer for that is the same for all countries. Those countries that have focused on key populations, namely men who have sex with men, people who buy and sell sex, transgender populations, and people who inject drugs, if we design good programs and implement programs with them, we see success. And when countries do not do that, they haven't achieved success. So it's doing the right thing the right way.
And overall, are infections mainly through sexual transmissions or drug use or a combination of both?
It's both. About 30% of the new infections here in Asia and the Pacific are through unsafe injection procedures. About somewhere in the range of 60 to 65% are sexual transmission, and then a small percent are due to mother-to-child transmission where the mom's HIV positive and passes that on through the birthing process.
And as you mentioned earlier, despite the good news, the statistics have also indicated new infections have actually risen in parts of South Asia, also in Indonesia. I guess it shows that countries still need to be ever vigilant against HIV/AIDS.
Absolutely, Sen. That's the message, is that you need to be doing the right thing, the right way, the right time. You have to be keeping your eyes on the ball. I think for years we used to be thinking of the Philippines and Sri Lanka and other countries as a low and slow epidemic. But in fact, once HIV gets into the injecting drug use community, it quickly can spread into other populations, and all at once you have a major epidemic.
For countries like Indonesia, what's the main reason, the primary reason for this backward step?
Well, I think what you've got is a continuation of drug use, injecting drug use, populations moving more into the injecting drug use, insufficient interventions for sex work, and then you also have in several provinces in Indonesia an epidemic that's being driven by men who have sex with men. So across the 16,000 islands of Indonesia, you see injecting drug use, commercial sex, as well as men who have sex with men. It's a challenging epidemic. The numbers are going down in Indonesia only really among a certain income level of sex workers. Otherwise, we see the rates going up.
And on this issue of male-to-male sex, as you say, there has been a rise in infections. Might we put that down to the invisibility, if you like? Their activities are often furtive and secret because many Asian countries do not have gay rights.
Yeah, unfortunately, instead of having universal access in many countries to HIV prevention care, treatment, and support, we have universal obstacles. And those universal obstacles include laws that are punitive, discriminatory, and in many cases illegal in international criteria. So, I mean, when countries focus in on punitive laws, when laws do not protect people, but make them more vulnerable, you see these communities at more risk of HIV.
Well, one of the few Asian countries that have a fairly vibrant gay rights movement is Taiwan. Do we know what the HIV situation is there?
Taiwan has, in the past, they've been doing some really innovative work with the community and tried to really get programs going into the communities by the communities with government support and clearance. So some good work there, both in terms of drug use as well as in sexual transmission. One of the things, Sun, that I would also really like to point out is that a number of countries in our region, and these are important countries like Indonesia, like China, like Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, these countries are increasingly moving towards a thing that we call expanding access to treatment. We know that if people living with HIV can get access to treatment, they not only benefit themselves from that health intervention, from accessing ARVs or antiretroviral drugs, but it's also very important that they will not transmit to other members of the community. So in those 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 countries, increasingly their national policies are not just only the prevention message, but making sure that key populations have access to treatment, and that means access to testing within their communities and treatment within their communities.
You mentioned better reporting earlier on. Burma, for instance, has seen dramatic changes over the past 24 months. What impact do you think have the tentative reforms in Burma had on HIV/AIDS?
Well, I think Burma has done just some impressive work. They have really tried to get on top of their epidemic. They've always had some very good prevention programs for both for those who use drugs as well as for commercial sexual networks. These programs have worked, and they've saved thousands and thousands of lives. Myanmar has not had the access to treatment that other countries have enjoyed. So the treatment coverage rates for people who need treatment today is only around 30%. So with the new interest by the international community to support and to accompany national processes in Myanmar and Burma, we now have new opportunities to really scale up treatment as well as the prevention programs. Myanmar's got pretty good data, and the data that they've got indicates real success in prevention, and with this new international engagement, real chances of getting on top of the treatment issues.
Well, Steve, the situation does seem fairly promising so far. So how on track are we to meeting the 2015 Millennium Development Goals?
Yeah. If you take a look today, if we continue just doing what we're doing today the same way out to the end of 2015, many countries will not meet their targets that they agreed to in June of last year in 2011. The reason for that is we have not scaled up prevention fast enough in some key priority countries. We have not been able to scale up treatment the way we wanted to, and we have not been able to change laws, policies, and regulations the way that we and other international members have called for. So we're not on track for the 2015 goals and targets. We're going to come close. But business as normal will not get us there. We're going to have to do more innovative work, take programs to where populations really are, make sure we do programs with the communities, particularly for key populations. We've got to expand treatment, both treatment as prevention as well as treatment for the individual. And then we really have to do a thorough review of laws, policies, and practices that are hindering the response.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Stay tuned. The Deputy Director of Solomon Islands College for Higher Education, Dr. Patricia Rohde, is hopeful the institution can be upgraded to become the country's first university. An in-principle proposal to establish a university is before the Parliament Bills and Legislation Subcommittee, and although there is no specific time frame, Dr. Rohde is confident that a bill may be sent to Parliament by the end of the year. She speaks next to Koronia Poger.
The bill is basically a proposal to transit Siche to SINU, the national university, for Siche's transition to university. It's a merge of what we currently have in the Siche Act. It's an improvement of that one that will enable Siche to become a university or to gain university status. And it provides for the basis for its functions, governance, management, and academic structures.
It is an expensive business establishing a university. Where would the money come from? Is that being discussed?
During the process of looking at the bill and working on a plan for Siche's transition to university, we have actually discussed that issue with the government officials, including the Minister of Finance. And since this initiative came from the government, the current government, they have made commitment to support the establishment of the university and its initial operations.
Presumably that's an agreement in principle at this stage.
That's an agreement in principle at this stage, but the government has assured us that they will make that commitment, and that has been factored into their budget for next year.
Quite separately, earlier this year, the Anglican Church in Melanesia said it would start raising money to build a university in Solomon Islands. At the time, it was suggested it would be open for students by 2015. Would it be more feasible to join forces and create a single institution, or are you convinced it's worth pushing ahead with plans that would ultimately have two universities in Solomon Islands?
I think the need for university studies is there. Solomon Islands has the capacity in terms of its population
to sustain two universities.
To sustain the two universities. I think we have only a very small percentage of Solomon Islanders are now undertaking university studies at USP in Fiji, as well as in some institutions in Australia and New Zealand. But the majority couldn't make it to regional institutions because of the costs, and I think having local universities or having a national university and more opportunities for Solomon Islanders to participate in university studies locally should be good for Solomon Islanders.
Now, you mentioned that the committee hasn't given you a time frame for when this bill, if it does go to Parliament, might actually be heard. But then on the other hand, you're saying that there are some funding agreements in principle from the government. Do you have a sense of how long it might be before a decision is taken on this proposal?
I think as soon as the Bills and Legislation Committee submit their report and the bill is put before Parliament for debate, we will hear the outcome. I'm hoping that it will happen before the end of this month.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Once again, if you wish to contact us, we always love to hear what you think of the program. Send us an email, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also catch past editions of the program by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. We're going to leave you today with a wonderful singer from the Pacific by the name of Janky Berg. He recently won the 2012 Pacific Break Contest from Radio Australia. And the recording that we're going to take a listen to is he recorded it live, actually, in the canteen of Radio Australia. And it's called My Oh My. So we hope you enjoy it. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye, everyone.
Saw her standing by the palm trees, fine from head to toe, creeping, peeping like she wants me. I think, ooh, I love you so. But my, oh my, oh, she looks so fly. I think, ooh, I love you so. Ain't my type, still you do just fine. I got to you, it's best you know. So I waited by the pavement for you catch my flow. Eyes flick sideways to erase me. I think I best just go. But my, oh my, oh, she looks so fly. I think, ooh, I love you so. Ain't my type, still you do just fine. I got to you, it's best you know. What's wrong? Was I staring too long? I think I see you with him standing by the trees. Ditch the scene, yeah, I'm out of here. You'll never know how much I really care. I really care. I really care. Yes, I do. Saw her standing by the palm trees, fine from head to toe. Creeping, peeping like she wants me. I think, ooh, I love you so. But my, oh my, oh, she looks so fly. I think, ooh, I love you so. Ain't my type, still you do just fine. I got to you, it's best you know.
You can hear PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question. There's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are various ways to catch the show. You can find it at my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Check out my blog at peteranthonyholder.blogspot.com. Find it at cyberstationusa.com, radioforall.net, or simply subscribe to it on iTunes. You've forgotten all those places already, haven't you? Okay, just Google the title. It's called the Stuff File Program, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Catch it, enjoy it, and have a chuckle or two. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Radio will never be the same again.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya, and nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.